Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined this time. We're recording this in Frank's office. How are you doing today, Frank?
I'm doing great. We have a change of venue.
I know. We're three doors down from where we usually record. Right. So we're about a little bit over a week and a half, I guess, since the tragic shooting in Las Vegas that I'm sure everyone is deeply aware of. And I thought this would be a good opportunity to talk about the history of both guns in the United States and the history of gun control in the United States.
Yes, sadly, David, we've talked about this a number of times as when we run through lists of potential topics. And it's quite a damning indictment that we say, well, we'll always have a chance to do that another time. Alas, that time has finally come.
And I'm sure we'll have another chance in the not-so-distant future, given the state of how these things unfold. You know, and it's just, it's a question that we, I think, I mean, at least I get this a lot from our students, because, of course, most of our students are British. Most of them have very little to no experience with guns. They don't see guns. They have no personal relationship with guns. The gun control, especially in the UK, is quite profound. It's, very, very hard to get a hold of a firearm. The police here don't carry firearms.
Well, don't routinely.
See
far more armed police than you used to.
To be sure. But oftentimes, they have to call out specially armed police, whereas, armed police is sort of redundant in the United States. What's your relationship, Frank, with firearms?
Well, before we get to that, David, just to follow up on your comment about our students and their perception, it's very interesting because the perception one gets from the media here, and certainly that many of our students have, is that guns are ubiquitous in the United States. And at some level they are.
Yes.
And of course, gun violence is a huge problem, and it always receives a huge amount of coverage here when these terrible events take place. But recent studies have shown that 3% of Americans own 50% of the guns in the country, and approximately 3/4 of Americans don't own any guns. And when I tell students, when I give them these facts, they're often quite surprised at it because they assume, essentially, there's one firearm for every person in the United States. They are not equally distributed.
To be sure.
This is part of the problem, frankly.
Yeah. Well, and they're not equally distributed geographically. There's some parts of the country where gun ownership is much more ubiquitous than others.
Indeed. And in fact, apropos of your question of my experience with guns, as somebody who grew up in Massachusetts and then in early adulthood came to Britain for a year and have been here ever since, my experience with guns is nil. I've never fired a gun in my life.
Okay.
I've never held a gun in my life.
Okay.
I have no experience with guns.
Okay.
Which may, for some listeners who may be on the other side of this issue, kind of invalidate my opinion.
You are unqualified to discuss guns if you haven't.
However, I'm qualified as a citizen and a historian.
Okay, fine.
What about you?
So I have some experience with guns. I was thinking about this yesterday. I first fired a rifle at camp when I think I was 9. So target shooting, bolt action rifle.
Where were you in camp?
Wisconsin.
Okay.
It was the camp my dad went to, and they decided to send me there. And, horseback riding, archery, riflery kind of stuff. And then in high school, I was on the rifle team. I was not very good. In fact, I was thoroughly mediocre. But
your high school had a rifle team?
Yeah. Yeah, our high school had a rifle team. Well, this university has a rifle team. Now, granted, I think they use, the laser-sighted things where it's not actually real bullets now. We have the university here actually has a rifle range.
Wow.
Things you don't know. Riflery is a...
Does your high school still have a rifle team? I wonder if, given the controversies over guns these days... High school rifle team.
So they were very, controlling about, the access to the firearms. So they were sort of locked up in a place that was locked inside. So access to it was very limited. And these are bolt-action rifles, which, fire one shot and then you have to, so they're not, in some ways, they're not all that radically dissimilar from, the kinds of guns people used 100 years ago. So, they're very different than obviously the kinds of guns that were used in Las Vegas or these other sort of shootings, Sandy Hook and what have you, that have been in the news.
So you were in a high school rifle team, and you've also lived in North
Dakota. Well, I lived in North Dakota. Yeah. Well, so, you know, especially in North Dakota, you know, the relationship there between people and guns is very different than most of the other places I've lived. I remember my first year there, I scheduled a midterm exam, and the student said, "You can't give a midterm exam then." I said, "Well, why not? I can give a midterm exam anytime, damn time I want to." And they said, "Well, that's the first day of hunting season. No one's going to be here. We're all leaving." I'm like, "Well, I'm having an exam then." They're like, "Well, we're not going to take it because it's the first day of hunting season." And, you know, they actually closed the public schools, you know, so the K through 12, because they realized none of the students and none of the teachers would show up on the first day of hunting season. So they just closed the schools. And so, you know, that culture, the hunting, going out and doing it, was so embedded that sort of the, you know, academic calendar had to sort of reflect that. I then proceeded to give all my exams after that on the first day of hunting season. Because hunting season's a week, so if they miss the first day, they say, "Well, that's always the best hunting on the first day." So I wanted to give Bambi more of a chance. But, you know, we were not supposed to have guns on campus, but there were guns on campus. They actually opened up a gun locker on campus when I was there because they knew that there were guns on campus and they just wanted to make sure that students stored them safely instead of in the back of their trucks. So that was eye-opening for me because I had done the riflery, which is, you know, one thing, but the hunting is the slightly, you know, two steps to the left of that.
But when you said, sorry, we need to get to the point, I'm interested in this guns on campus question. When students brought guns on campus, were they bringing hunting rifles? They weren't bringing handguns.
I prefer not to think too much about that, especially, you know, but I think they were mostly bringing hunting rifles.
Right. Interesting. And what about North Carolina?
I mean, I was in a university town, so there was a slightly different sort of mentality towards guns there than there was in other parts of the state. So if you went to the Walmart, you know, in Chapel Hill, I don't think they had the guns as much on display in the Walmart in Chapel Hill as they did in the Walmart in rural parts of the state. You know, and Walmart, of course, I think is the largest purveyor of firearms in the United States. Yeah, so that's my personal relationship with firearms. Now, I've known people who have been, guns still scare me. I mean, even as somebody who has some, you know, limited exposure to working with firearms, I still get profoundly scared when I see people with firearms, even, you know, people that are, you know, good guys with a gun, supposedly.
Yes, this is one of the things we're always told, that the antidote to a bad guy with a gun is a
good guy with a gun. Yeah, even that sort of makes me feel uneasy.
I mean, it is interesting because you began with a comparison between Britain and the United States, and this is one of the areas where the two countries are starkly different. Mm-hmm. Not long before I came to Scotland, and a few years after I arrived in the UK, the worst school shooting in British history mm-hmm. took place when a man went into a school in near here in mm-hmm. Dunblane, Scotland. And killed 16 children and their teacher, and that shocked people here.
Yeah.
Well, it was a shocking and horrendous incident and event, but the result was even stricter gun control. Mm-hmm. And there are still occasional shootings in the UK, but they're newsworthy when they happen as a result. And one of the things that always pops up on social media. Whenever and the memes on Facebook and Twitter and whatnot after one of these shootings in the United States, the example of Australia where mm-hmm. they had a mass shooting 20 or 25 years ago, and the result was a very strict crackdown on guns, and that worked. And so these are always held up, and Onion headline from the satirical website that comes up every time this occurs is, you know, "There's nothing to do about this," says the only country in the world
where this happens. Because, you know, it does seem that, you know, in other countries when these events break out, you know, the immediate response is to implement gun control. And, you know, every time we have a shooting over the past 25 years, people say, "Well, is this the time we're going to have gun control?" And you know, it never seems like it goes anywhere.
Well, it all goes back, of course, to the Second Amendment. I mean, when what's held up as the reason why America is, and I'm using this term deliberately in this context, exceptional.
Yes.
You know, is because of the second, allegedly because of the Second Amendment to the Constitution. The Second Amendment is adopted, just to make sure we're all on the same page, adopted in 1791 as part of the Bill of Rights. It's the Second Amendment to the Constitution. And it stipulates, and let me just make sure I get the language exactly correct, because the language does matter here. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And so this is the origin story, if you will, for guns in America to some extent. Although there's a prehistory that's really, really important. And the prehistory, indeed, I happen to be drinking out of my Minuteman National Park mug right now, which I'm holding up to the microphone.
We'll take a picture and post it on...
Yes, we'll post, post it on picture, Twitter.
Yes, yes, Frank modeling with Minuteman mug.
And I deliberately chose that because the Minutemen, of course, were militiamen who fought against British rule in the early days of the American Revolution, the War of American Independence. And there's a kind of myth. Myth is the wrong way to put it because it has foundation in fact. During the colonial period, every community had militia, had a militia. And these were kind of able-bodied adult men who trained and drilled in order to defend their communities, either against Native Americans or the French or down south, certainly, acted as slave patrols. And there's a kind of collective right of self-defense that's embedded in the nation's DNA from the beginning. And you know, and so it's the Minutemen, these kind of elite militia who turn out at Lexington and Concord in April of 1775 in the first battle of the War of Independence. And militia play a really prominent role throughout the War of Independence. And the role of the militia and the role of individuals taking up arms in a body together with their neighbors to defend
their own arms.
Taking up their own arms, that's right. Well, yes and no. I mean, in some case, there's a debate as to how well-armed some of these militias were. Right. To some extent, the Minutemen existed because they were the ones who owned guns, whereas the more general militia may not have. But yes, taking up their own arms to defend their communities and defend their rights is kind of well enshrined in American history and has a basis in fact. And this lies behind, or is the crucial background to the Second Amendment. Now, we do need to consider the Second Amendment. I want to read this again carefully because the emphasis today is on the second part of it, which stipulates the right of the people.
The emphasis by some people today.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. those who advocate ready access to guns.
Yes.
Stress the second part, which says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, if you are an advocate of relatively lax regulation of guns, you say, well, that's pretty clear. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. However, there is an earlier, the earlier clause there really matters, at least to others who read it differently, and I think you and I are probably in agreement on this.
Yes.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. That's the clause that comes before. Now, there are two elements to that that I think are really important. The first is regulated. There's a recognition that regulation is part of this.
Yeah.
And so and the gun ownership that follows is directly connected, it seems to me, in my reading of it, to the concept of a well-regulated militia.
Yes.
And a well-regulated militia is just that. It's meant to be a body of individuals. Now we would say men and women, but in the context of 1791, a body of men who are acting under the auspices of the government in some way, or a local government.
Or at least their community.
Or their community. They're representing their community to... They're ordered in some way. They're regulated. The phrase regulated means that they're subject to some kind of government oversight or community oversight to preserve liberty.
Now, I hate to...
I want to finish. Yeah. It's not a bunch of guys who just take out their guns and get a Don't Tread on Me flag and turn up in Charlottesville necessarily and call themselves a militia.
Now, I don't want to sort of say bad things about the Founding Fathers, except sometimes I'd say, this is the worst goddamn sentence, like, in the whole Constitution. In as much as, like, as a sentence, it doesn't... Like, there's these two clauses that don't really work together. It's, like, well-regulated by who? It doesn't say. You know, if we were sort of marking this, we would tell them, you know, rewrite this sentence for clarity, you know, because, you know, there's no indication about, you know, who is supposed to regulate the militia, what regulation looks like, you know, how the right to bear arms relates to the militia. Is this an individual right? Is this a collective right? You know, there's a gray area in the Constitution. Sometimes it's strength, but in this case, no one really knows what the hell that's.
I would push back a little bit, David, in the sense that one of the ironies we have here is many people who support widespread ownership of guns or access to gun ownership, or relatively easy access to gun ownership would be the way to phrase it, are often kind of constitutional originalists. Mm. And they, you know, so they believe that we should be able to go back to the period and interpret it as the founders or the framers wanted to, and we should be literalists. They're like biblical fundamentalists in some sense. Well, I think the context here matters. Immediately before the Constitution was drafted, of course, Shays' Rebellion took place in Massachusetts. And this was a rebellion in western Massachusetts of hard-pressed farmers and Revolutionary War veterans, some of whom took up arms against the state in their view to resist unjust taxation and financial and state laws. The details need not detain us, except this was one of the proximate causes of the calling of the Constitutional Convention, which was called in response to Shays' Rebellion, and frankly, because of the fear of what Shays' Rebellion represented, which was a mob taking up arms. And so Shays' Rebellion is sometimes held up as an example of exactly what the Second Amendment should promote, when quite the contrary. Right. I think Shays' Rebellion, the Second Amendment was drafted with events like Shays' Rebellion in mind, saying, this is what the state has a right to stop. And Shays' Rebellion was actually suppressed by militia from eastern Massachusetts, called out by the state to put down this disorder. Yeah. I think that's the well-regulated militia that matters. And the reason context matters here, if we're trying to get back to what the original intent of the framers, I think that's the original intent.
And thinking decade later, with the Whiskey Rebellion, Whiskey Rebellion, you've got the government calling out the militia to suppress, you know, Western farmers rebelling, you know, very similar kind of way as Shays' Rebellion, against taxation they felt was unfair. But they saw that was being an unlawful assembly of.
That's right, and in fact, that's possibly even a better example because it's the name of our podcast. No, but also because it's after the Second Amendment has been adopted. And so there's an example where the federal government and the individuals who were alive when the Second Amendment was framed,
right, and the guys who framed it, not
yes,
really alive,
had an interpretation where they said, "Look, what's going on in Western Pennsylvania is unacceptable."
And we're going to suppress it.
So you're right. There's ambiguity in this amendment, and that's hugely problematic. However, I think that first part about a well-regulated militia, those words, those four words, a well-regulated militia, tell us something. Regulated and militia. It suggests it's a collective right of the people to defend their liberties, but it needs to be regulated. That's my reading of it.
There's a debate about, you know, thinking about the revolutionary generation and also going to the colonial period, how ubiquitous guns were. What's your feeling? Yeah, so some of the mythologies, everybody had a gun, guns were in everybody's household. What do you think about the debate about whether that's reflected in reality or not?
I've got to confess, this is not an area of my particular expertise, and I have read on it, and as you know, there's some controversy over this question. I suspect, the image that every single colonial American or every single American on the eve of the revolution owned a gun is overstated. Mm. If that were true, then the Patriots, once they rebel, wouldn't have needed to appeal to the French for arms to fight the British. Clearly not everyone owned firearms. Although firearms were in wide circulation, they were tools of imperialism and imperial expansion. So there are a lot of guns in North America, thanks to, you know, Native Americans have guns, settlers have guns, the British are trading guns, the French are trading guns. So there are guns in circulation. Yeah. However, I suspect they're not nearly as ubiquitous as popular culture would have us believe, and as the kind of mythic founding of the country would have us believe. It seems to me that we have to go forward to your period. Once you get the well, first of all, industrialization and mass production. And the kind of circulation of guns actually, the kind of mass circulation of guns doesn't take place until later. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would, but I would add sort of a caveat that there are, I think, lots of guns in the antebellum period that are floating around, and often people you don't expect to have access to guns have access to guns.
Such as?
Well, slaves often had access to guns.
Because they can hunt.
So some slaves can hunt, some slaves had access to firearms to scare away birds that ate rice. You know, when students encounter these, with Charles Ball, for instance, a slave in South Carolina, writes about this extensively. His owner gives him a gun, and all my students are kind of shocked by this. Like, why would they give him a gun? Well, it's because most of the guns were pretty lousy.
Yeah, that's another thing to bear in mind.
You know, these are very slow to load. They require, you know, you can supposedly you can fire 3 shots a minute, but that's only if you're really good and no one's firing back at you. You know, so they're slow and difficult to load. They're not particularly accurate. They're accurate. Most of these guns are accurate to maybe 60 yards. And that's, you know, hitting the side of a barn with it. They're difficult. You know, they're a skilled weapon to use. They're not something you can pick up and accidentally discharge. The sort of, you know, the peril that American parents have today of their child finding a handgun and accidentally shooting themselves. That's not going to happen with an, you know, 18th or 19th century musket, because you don't leave those loaded. You have to. You
know, yes, and one of the images is they're always hanging over the
fireplace.
You wouldn't put a gun over the
fireplace. No, that's probably not. But you know, so they're very different kinds of, you know. So when they're thinking about what a right to bear arms meant in a constitutional context, their image of what a gun is a very different kind of tool. You don't have any mass shootings, you know, in the 18th and 19th century, because you don't have any guns that can fire that often.
No, in fact, one reason why you need a collective use of guns in the militia is because that's the only way you can actually be effective, is 15 men stand together and fire at something.
Yeah.
One thing I'd say is I had a seminar yesterday, but I'm teaching a course on the American Revolution right now with our honor students, and they were reading, the seminar this week happened to be on the War of Independence, and they were reading, I had the students read a pension application that a Revolutionary War veteran made in the 1820s. And he was reflecting on his experience. And some of these are incredibly rich. They've got wonderful narratives attached to them. And this guy tells a story about how they confronted, he and some of his fellow soldiers saw a Hessian soldier, a German mercenary who was fighting for the British, who was on picket duty, and they were deciding whether to shoot him or not, and they have a debate about whether to shoot him, and they're, and the guy who is the deponent who gives this deposition was the man who was selected to shoot him because he was the best marksman in the unit. But he said in his account that he didn't want to kill a man in cold blood, so he shot him in the leg. And the students were impressed by this account, and I said, well, hold on, there's no way
you can't aim.
He chose to shoot him in the leg.
Yeah.
I said he probably shot him, hit him in the leg,
and then rationalized
it. And then rationalized it after the fact, or said, that's what I decided to do. So apropos of your point about the accuracy of guns.
If anything, shooting them in the leg is worse, because then it's going to die slowly and painfully.
Right. You know? So it was an interesting account, but they sort of took it as read that you could make this decision to shoot somebody in the leg in 1780, I just don't think that's the case.
You know, and even going into the Civil War era, one of the big sort of technological transformations in firearms between the Revolution and the Civil War, historically, has always been the introduction of rifling, which allows the bullet to spin, so it goes like spins like an American football. So transatlantic podcast. This is always an explanation that makes more sense when I teach this in America than when I teach it here. It makes the guns more accurate, makes the bullets fly further. In practice, though, it actually, you know, aiming these guns is hard because the bullets actually don't go that fast, and so they drop. And so often, even if you're shooting, even a gun that's supposedly accurate for 200 yards, unless you have it sighted exactly right, you're either going to shoot over the people or your bullet's going to hit the ground at their feet. And so it's in some ways more like firing a cannon and needing to sort of factor in all these kinds of things, which is obviously very hard to do. So even, you know, introduction of rifling doesn't make these guns particularly accurate.
So gun ownership is common,
yes,
perhaps not as widespread as people believe, but the guns themselves are not terribly useful or accurate. Is that a fair?
Yeah, I think so.
Is that where we are in the mid 19th century? And or late 18th, early 19th century?
When you think about Harper's Ferry, for instance, from 1859, John Brown arms all his men with pikes. And the soldiers, my students are always like, why don't they give them guns? Like, well, guns aren't actually all that useful in close quarter combat if you're charging somebody. Pikes are pretty easy to learn how to use. Guns are hard to use. And guns, once you've fired them, are kind of useless. They end up being sort of a big stick you can poke somebody with.
Yeah, well, you either use a bayonet or use it as a club.
Exactly. But it's not a particularly, as effective, the kind of thing we think of when we think of firearms.
So, when do things change?
In terms of both military guns and civilian guns, I think there's the point in which we start to get automatic weapons. So you start to see things, versions of automatic weapons being experimented with in the late 19th century, but then used extensively, really, in the First World War.
Sorry, back up, David. What about the Wild West, though? I mean, everybody's seen Westerns. Everybody's seen shootouts in the streets and all this kind of stuff. What about
A lot of that is much sort of mythology. I mean, to be sure, lots of people outside and in the West had guns. But there's a lot of mythology attached to that, and even in some of these sort of Wild West towns, one of the regulations they imposed upon people was when you come into town, you have to surrender your firearms. So in some ways, these were gun-free zones, to use the modern nomenclature.
Yes, the Johnny Cash song about don't take your guns to town. You couldn't take your guns to town. Exactly. Dodge City.
Yeah, no, and in all these little sort of gambling mining towns, there was often gun-free zones, at least in theory. So I think a lot of that is mythology, and some of it's mythology I think that people have inherited from 1950s era John Wayne movies as much as from the historical reality of what the Wild West is had a longer lifespan in cinemas than it did actually in real life as a sort of time and a place.
But technology does move on in the 20th century.
And I think that's really where thinking about gun control and gun regulation, it's in response to weapons that are categorically different than even your Civil War era rifle musket. It's with introductions of things like the Tommy gun in the 1920s when you start to see during Prohibition,
which is a machine gun.
We both know next to nothing about guns. Somebody who's listening to this who knows a lot about guns is going to point out all the things we're getting wrong. But I think that's really a point in which people start to think about firearms differently, because all of a sudden you have a gun who can kill a bunch of people. And so you start to see really the first federal gun control regulation in response to that. So in 1934, you have the National Firearms Act that makes owning an automatic weapon illegal. And that's in response, obviously, you have this technology that was built in the end of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, perfected during the First World War, and then, beyond that, sort of miniaturized even more in the 20s and used by Chicago gangsters in the, St. Valentine's Day Massacre in 1929. Then you have sort of this movement to actually sort of regulate these kinds of weapons, noting that, automatic weapons are fundamentally different than your hunting rifle. And that, the role of the state is to intervene there. And so the prohibition on automatic weapons that we still have is based on this 1934 law that was introduced to combat gang violence during Prohibition.
Right, and for much of the 20th century, those laws, that law worked. There were occasional shootings, but gun violence was not nearly as pronounced, say, 50 years ago as it is today.
Thinking about the relationship between violence and legislation, there's another law that's passed in 1968, the Gun Control Act of 1968, because they were uncreative in naming conventions. Which is passed in the aftermath of the Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King assassinations, that places regulations on interstate trade of firearms. So that opens up in response to some very specific uses of firearms. But you know, it's, I think the landscape about gun control regulation really changes in, and sort of the politics of it changes in the late 70s and early 80s. I think.
Right, and the National Rifle Association, the NRA, is yes. always associated with that.
Yeah.
But it's founded during your period.
Yeah,
there.
So it's
founded.
Yeah,
about
so
that?
The
because they're going to come to the fore in the 70s and 80s. But what's the prehistory?
So the prehistory, well, the first century of the NRA, it's founded in 1871, and so it's founded in the aftermath of the Civil War, and basically, it was founded because most of the people who fought in the Civil War were really lousy at shooting using guns. I mean, people came in never having fired a gun, a lot of them, or if they had, they weren't very good. And so it's designed to try to inculcate a sportsman culture.
I mean, if one goes back before the Civil War, sorry to interrupt you, but just briefly, some of the accounts of the migration on the Overland Trails, to the Pacific West, so to Oregon and Washington and to California. Yeah. A lot of these Easterners from Eastern cities who'd never owned guns arm themselves because they think they have to fight Indians mm-hmm. when they get out to the West, or that the Wild West yes. is, or the West is going to be wild. But in some of these accounts, they're shooting themselves in the foot, literally shooting themselves in the foot, because they don't know how to use guns.
They're difficult to use,
and they accidentally go off or they drop them. And
So I mean, loading a 19th century rifle is not easy.
And that continues into the Civil War, you're saying?
Yeah. So in 1871, they establish it, and it's designed to sort of create a sporting culture very similar to that actually exists in the UK, where sort of aristocrats go off and shoot, pheasants or something. It's a design and have shooting competitions. So they just, it's built around that model where you have rifle ranges and have shooting competitions, and they have rifle teams. And so actually the rifle team I was on in a prep school in Connecticut in some ways is a direct descendant of these rifle teams that were established in 1871. The first president, this is historical trivia, but fun nonetheless because I like him. The first president of the NRA is Ambrose Burnside, who is usually described as a spectacularly bad Civil War general with great facial hair. Google him and see what his facial hair looks like, listeners. You'll be amazed.
It's the golden age of facial hair in the 19th century.
Frank's been trying to sort of live up to that with his, but you got a long ways to go before you're in Ambrose Burnside territory. Other sort of military political leaders, people like Ulysses S. Grant are president of the NRA. But it's very much around teaching people how to use firearms safely and how to use, they sponsor competitions, they send teams around the world. The American teams end up being moderately good by the, 20th century.
So, in its origins, and I know we need to move on, the NRA is helping people to be better shots, but also safer?
Yes. Yeah, I know. I think part of it is, these guns are dangerous, and you need to learn how to use them properly. And that's something that the NRA continues to do in the 20th century. So they do lots of gun safety classes. They have sort of certificate training courses people go through.
When does it become a political lobbying organization?
Well, so it's interesting because, in the 1930s, when you start to have this gun control regulation, the NRA comes out in favor of it. They say, these are not the guns that we're talking about. We want rifles and we want, target shooting and we want, hunting. We don't want gangsters with Tommy guns. So they're actually in favor of that. The turning point seems to be in the 1970s. When they're looking at the legislation that was passed in the 60s, they're thinking that there's going to be likely legislation. Then there's sort of a coup that happens in some ways in the NRA when it goes from being a target shooting and hunting organization to being a gun freedom advocacy group. And one of the things that happens when it makes that transition is that lots of the gun manufacturers then start to pour money into the NRA to help with lobbying organizations against gun legislation. So they endorsed their first political candidate in 1980 when the NRA endorses Ronald Reagan.
But it's as late as 1980. Interesting.
And one of the things that's happened since then is the NRA has a phenomenal amount of money and influence with its members. And so it's able to, it rates all the congressmen and gives them grades based on how gun-friendly they are. And so it's actually a fairly recent transition from the NRA from being a club for people who enjoyed hunting and, you know, sports shooting, to people who are Second Amendment fundamentalists.
Right, and the Second Amendment fundamentalism, as I read, so we have the rise of the NRA in the 70s and 80s, yeah, as a political organization, yeah, say, or the increase in its influence in that period. But the kind of interpretation of the Second Amendment and the emphasis on, well, I think you used the right phrase, Second Amendment fundamentalism, really is also late. It's the late 80s and early 90s when some gun rights advocates really embrace this interpretation of the Second Amendment as meaning no regulation on firearms, essentially. And any attempt to regulate firearms in any way is a danger to liberty and a threat to the Second Amendment.
Well, there's two pieces of legislation that I think they're responding to in the 90s. And the first is the Brady Handgun Bill in 1993.
And so named after the
press secretary for Ronald Reagan who was shot when Reagan was shot.
James Brady.
Yes. And it was handicapped as a consequence of that. Yes. And, yeah, he was shot in the head, if I recall correctly. So that was a bill that was introduced in 93. And actually, as a piece of gun control legislation, it was, it required background checks for buying a gun and set up a sort of federal system for doing that. But it had more loopholes than, you know. So it had a loophole if you wanted to buy guns at gun shows. It had loopholes if you wanted to sell guns privately. So there was a, you know, it's designed to keep guns out of the hands of criminals and the mentally ill. But it set up situations where it was still very easy for people who shouldn't have guns to continue to have guns. And the assault gun ban in 1994. Which had a sunset provision on, so I think it lasted until 2000-something, maybe 2004, before that sort of expired. And I think both those pieces of legislation, even if neither of them was particularly effective as actual gun control, I think the argument that the Second Amendment fundamentalists could use is, this is the first step, they're going to make it harder to get guns, and then they're going to come and take away your guns. You know, this idea that the federal government was going to disarm its people, and that, you know, if they're going to take away your assault rifle, then the next they're going to take away your regular rifle, and then they're going to take away your handgun, and then they're going to take away your freedom.
Right, and this does resonate with, you know, back to where we began, an interpretation of the origins of the American Revolution and the American Republic.
Yeah.
You know, that oppressed subjects had to take up arms themselves in order to defend their liberty and the liberty of their communities. And it's a particularly resonant interpretation of the past that informs this interpretation.
Yeah, to be sure.
Or informs these views, I should say.
And one other thing I think is interesting about thinking about the Second Amendment and what it means is actually the case law, the Supreme Court's interpretations of the Second Amendment, those are all relatively recent. So it's not unlike the other amendments, unlike the First Amendment, you know, or the Fourth or the Fifth Amendment, in which there's a huge sort of body of precedent for understanding and making sense of what this means. The Second Amendment doesn't have that sort of robust level of court precedent to work from.
No, the most important case is only less than a decade old, really. It's the Heller decision.
Yeah, 2008.
Yeah.
Which, you know, the Heller decision was about a handgun ban in the District of Columbia. And in that case, the Supreme Court struck that ban down, saying that, you know, I think Scalia wrote the...
I've got something to say about that.
You know, in which he said that the, you know, right to bear arms in the Second Amendment is an individual right. There's a debate about whether it was an individual or collective right. It's an individual right, and the government can't regulate it. And then there's 2 years later, or 3 years later, a case in Chicago, which sort of expanded that, because D.C. is obviously in this weird sort of anomalous legal category, because it's not of a state. There was a regulation in the city of Chicago that banned handguns, and they struck that down as well on similar.
I mean, with regard to the Heller decisions, that really is a turning point where this fundamentalist interpretation of the Second Amendment enters seems to prevail,
yeah, yeah.
at least for the time being. What's interesting about that is Scalia, who wrote the majority decision, was one of the leading originalists,
yeah.
and really thought you needed to both go back and look at what the framers of the Constitution intended, but also interpret the text as
yeah.
quite closely. He's not doing so in that decision yeah. because he's ignoring the first part of the amendment, the well-regulated mm-hmm. militia part yeah. of it. So here we have an originalist who's not actually being an originalist, if you yes. will. So there's kind of intellectual contradiction mm-hmm. there, it seems to me,
yeah.
In that decision. But that's the decision that seems to vindicate the interpretation that the right to bear arms is an individual right and the government can't regulate
yeah.
guns at all, effectively. Yeah. And help bring us to the place we're in
today.
Now,
well, now I mean, there's an interesting, you know, the after every one of these shootings, there's a debate about whether we're going to have gun control. And I guess after Sandy Hook, I kind of stopped paying attention to those because I realized
Sandy Hook being the
mass shooting of an elementary school in which dozens of you know, 5-year-olds were killed. You know, if we can't have gun control after that, I'm not optimistic. But after this shooting in Las Vegas, there is some debate about banning the bump stocks, the particular sort of modification that was added to the guns to make a semi-automatic rifle into an automatic rifle.
Which was the distinction that allowed him to shoot too many people.
Right. And the NRA seems to be saying, in an interesting sort of move on their part, you know, they're willing to entertain banning these particular modifications.
Yeah, it's a pretty minor concession.
I think
they're trying to get ahead of the curve, so that yeah. to prevent legislation. It is interesting though, because you're right. It's the one kind of moment where they seem to have moderated their tone and yeah. their position slightly. But I think they're doing so in order to avoid more stringent regulation.
So, Frank, it seems like the NRA may or may not be making nominal turn on this. What do you think that the likelihood is in the future of actual meaningful gun control regulation?
Oh, David, I don't know. I mean,
given our expertise in the past and not in the future.
No, I know. And every time we make a prediction, it's wrong. I'll say a couple of things. This has to stop.
Yes.
You know, it is madness.
Yes.
And the 30,000 Americans are killed every year, or 33,000 every single year, owing to gun violence. Most of those are suicides or accidents. But the
suicides are also sort of a symptom of a culture that's...
Right,
you know,
right. Yeah. Anyway, but the fact remains that, you know, that's 30,000 people a year who may not die otherwise.
Mm.
And... It has to stop, it yes. seems to me. At the moment, things look bleak because of the power of the NRA. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that they've shown a little bit of flexibility in response to Las Vegas, but I think that's in order to
mm-hmm.
get out in front of this and try to forestall any serious efforts.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say two things, however. One is the Second Amendment is an amendment. The Constitution has an amendment procedure.
Mm-hmm.
It is not holy writ. That's why there's an amendment procedure. Theoretically, it could be repealed. Now, the chances of that, I think,
we have repealed an amendment before.
Well, yes, we have. Yeah. But there's a legal avenue that way. But what I do draw comfort from is your period, in the sense that your horrible period where there's slavery and America tears itself apart. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that happened, if you'd said to Americans in 1820, in the during the Missouri crisis, what are we going to do about slavery? People would have said, there's no real solution. We're never going to solve this.
Mm.
And indeed...
The wolf by the ears.
Yeah. It was a mess.
Yeah.
But people worked at it for years and decades.
Mm.
And slavery was abolished at a tremendous cost.
Well, I was thinking it's like three-quarters
of
a million people.
I'm not advocating a civil war over this. Well,
No. That listener's Frank is not advocating a civil war.
Thank you. Thank you. So, but what I mean is campaigns for... change and justice often take a long time. So I don't think people should give up. There's too much at stake. Three-quarters of Americans don't own guns.
And the number of Americans who's owning guns is going down every year.
Right. And foreign visitors, don't stay away from America over this issue. There may be other reasons you want to stay away from America. This is horrendous, but it doesn't represent the whole country. And I have this faith in the goodwill and democratic sensibilities, small d democratic sensibilities of the American people. Yeah. And this has to change, and we have to keep advocating for it.
Okay, I wish Well, I wish I shared your optimism. I mean, part of me does, and part of me has grown just profoundly skeptical on this issue, because I thought after Columbine, okay, we'll have something, and that was 20 years ago. And it's just sort of, every 6 months it seems like there's, another huge one that's newsworthy, and the fact is there's so many small ones now that, five people get shot, that's not a newsworthy story.
Yeah, it's about one a day, average. Yeah,
of mass shootings.
Yeah, a mass shooting being, four or more.
And so the fact that these things are happening at such a phenomenal rate, and that very little is, the politicians express their thoughts and prayers, and then do nothing, just infuriates me.
Yes, I will no longer use the phrase, well, I've never used it, but the phrase thoughts and prayers drives me crazy now. Because as far as I'm concerned, it's a statement of doing, that I'm not going
to
do anything.
Yeah, my wife and daughter are going back to the States tomorrow for the first time in a couple of years. They both express slight apprehensions about what America looks like now, and it's not all that different what America looked like 2 years ago, but I think just the context of living here for 2 years, where guns aren't ubiquitous, and we don't have these kinds of episodes, makes them think twice about it.
Well, they have my thoughts and prayers for the trip.
They're going to Orlando, so who knows. Yeah, what last drops, Frank? What do you got?
Last drop. I went to see Blade Runner 2049.
Oh, I've not seen it. No spoilers, please.
I won't give any spoilers. I will say, it's interesting because, as is frequently the case with science fiction, but especially dystopian science fiction, which this is, it says much about the period in which it's produced. So the original in the 1980s, the Ridley Scott film, when Harrison Ford is the star, presents this dystopian view of Los Angeles about now.
Yeah.
And we still don't have flying cars. I want to make that clear. And the original was a bit of a cult classic, and it paid homage to the kind of noir detective tradition and science fiction. And it was very good. I think the new one is very good as well. Don't see the new one unless you've seen the first one.
Yeah, I'm going to take my younger son to go see it over the weekend, but we're going to watch the original first. But I have to figure out which version of the original to watch, because there's five versions.
Director's cuts.
Well, there's director's special recuts and other kinds of nonsense.
So anyway, but you can't see the new one won't make sense unless you've seen the first one. In fact, what's interesting to me, a couple things is. I was sitting there with a friend, and we were watching it, and there was a young couple next to us who were clearly on a date, and they got up and left about an hour and a half into it, because I suspect it didn't make any sense to them.
Okay.
I think you do have to,
as a date movie, make sure you've seen the original film.
It's also not really a date movie, but in terms of its dystopian take, the Los Angeles of 2049 is an environmental catastrophe. It's are armed.
Given the fires in the greater California,
Even bleaker than the version 30 years ago that Ridley Scott produced. The other thing I'll observe, and this is grumpy old man territory, Jesus, it's a long movie. It's nearly 3 hours, and I just don't know why movies have to be so long anymore. Make your movie in 2 hours, for goodness sake.
It's Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings. Yeah, everything. Yeah,
afterwards,
ruined it for everybody. But it's good. And if you like the original, you should definitely see it. It's very good. It's a little too long.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, like this podcast, it should be
crisp and concise.
Exactly.
Okay. Well,
what's your last drop, Dave?
So I want to endorse another podcast. This is from the people at Radiolab, which is. I assume most people who listen to podcasts are familiar with Radiolab. They've been an extraordinary podcast for years. But it, I guess last year they started a new sort of spin-off called More Perfect, which is about the Supreme Court. And their most recent episode, they talked to descendants of Dred Scott, the slave in question, this famous Supreme Court case, and Roger Taney, who was the Chief Justice who wrote the decision, which is widely considered to be the worst decision the Supreme Court has ever made. But talked to the descendants about what it meant to be descended from these figures and what sort of the legacy of it has been. They got them together in a hotel in St. Louis, and they talked to each other, and they, you know, the Taney descendant talked about sort of what it meant for him, and he apologized, and the Dred Scott descendant said, maybe you don't really need to apologize, it's not your fault. And it was a really sort of interesting way to sort of think about the legacy, the personal legacies of obviously a very critically important historical event. So I want to recommend that episode of More Perfect.
Excellent. Oh, I have one last thing to say before we wrap up,
yes.
Which is I met a listener.
You met a listener?
I met a listener, and I promised I'd mention her name because she loves the podcast.
Oh.
And her name's Megan.
Oh.
She's from Ireland. And,
well, hi, Megan. Thank you for listening.
So, Megan, thank you for listening, and tell your friends. So, Megan,
yes.
We appreciate your support. Anyway,
all right. On that
cheers,
note,
David.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.